Live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
To just talk us through some of what we are starting to see, not starting, but I mean, we are seeing a lot of it in schools now, these cases of racism. And I just want us to have a deeper conversations about what possibly could be informing the actions of these young pupils. Asanda Nwasheng, thank you so much for making time for us. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening and thank you for having me.
What questions should we be asking with the advent of what seems to be quite a, I don't know, there seems to be an acceleration of these cases that we're seeing at schools?
Well, I think, you know, it's not that racism stopped in schools because we were not talking about it. Maybe it's that there's more reporting on it for various reasons. But racism continues in our schools as an everyday thing, just like it continues and is an everyday thing in our workplaces, in our churches, in our community WhatsApp groups, and anywhere really where there are humans of different races. And so the question is not so much whether racism is happening, but what we are trying to do as communities, as schools, as workplaces, in order to end racism. Because, you know, racism is actually a taught ideology. Nobody is born hating, as Mandela said. No one is born hating someone else. But it's something that they, as people grow, they begin to learn that society works and operates in different ways. I've often said that, you know, a child, by the time they are, you know, conscious enough, even before they have words, they know that, you know, Black people in South African society are the domestic workers, are the cleaners, are the waiters and waitresses, and white people are the bosses, and those, and they are the people with authority. And so as children grow of all races, they begin to recognize that race means something in this country, and that race, you know, is kind of a code for something. And the code that it is that Black people are there to be in service to people, and white people are there to be the bosses and to lead people. And so until we see a transformation in society in terms of who owns the economy of South Africa and who is listed on the JSE, so that it's less of what it is now, which is majority white, and it is majority Black and represents the population of this country, we're not going to go very far. But what particularly the case in Cape Town really was interesting to me, because you have, you know, members or young people from the colored population, which is a population that we know has, you know, descendants of people who were enslaved, people who were enslaved and brought to South Africa from Malaysia, people who were enslaved and brought to South Africa from China, from Brazil, from the rest of the continent of Africa. And so you have children who are literally playing out their very own ancestors' trauma as a joke. And that, to me, tells me that parents are not having the difficult conversations that they need to be having. Because if parents are having the difficult conversations and we're telling their kids what it to be colored in South Africa, what is the history of colored people in South Africa, and how did this identity of colored come to be, then you wouldn't have seen the scenes that we were seeing. Because even if it was a teacher that said you must do this or whatever happened, those children would have refused, because they would have understood that they would be mocking the pain of their ancestors. But these things happen because we, of course, have, as I've said, this population that comes out of slavery and then finds itself being given this identity. And what then happens is that we have apartheid, which then comes in and builds what is called the hierarchy of humanity. And within this hierarchy of humanity, it says that, you know, Black Africans are at the bottom of the bottom of you know, whatever totem pole. And then you have white people at the top, followed very, very soon after by Indian people, and then colored people. And so this hierarchy, this superiority that says white people are better than, that says Indian people are better than, that says colored people are better than, is then taken on and becomes part of the identity. So you would have seen in Linasia every once in a while, there's, you know, some fracas that happens when the Department of Education hires a Black person to be a teacher at a colored school. You'll see this even in Cape Town when similar things happen, or if the government allocates land to former squatter camp dwellers from, you know, from the Black population in a so-called colored neighborhood. We see people up in arms. We don't want to live with these people. We don't want these people to be part of our lives. They are criminals. They're going to do all of this. because as a country, we have never dealt with what apartheid meant for all of us and how we saw each other in apartheid. So we removed the laws, but we didn't remove what sat in people's heads, what sat in people's hearts, and what people actually believed. And this is really the work that diversity training tries to do, is to try to help people to understand the impact of the past on the present, and to help people to understand how these laws that segregated us, because it is these very laws, by the way, I often say that, you know, South Africans don't understand something, which is that Black South Africans have only been South Africans in identity since 1994. Before 1994, Black South Africans could not have a South African ID. They belonged to homelands, whether it was the Ciskei or the Transkei or Botswana or any of the many homelands. We were not allowed to be South Africans. Only colored Indian and white people were allowed to be South African. And so there is resonance amongst those racial groups around how the treatment of Black people should be, around the inferiority that lives in people's... People believe that Black people are inferior, that as long as they're not Black, they are better. And in fact, this was baked into the apartheid system, because when the colored identity came to being, people were actually told that you can stay as a native. So those who had Khoi lineage were told that you can stay as a native, as a Griqua, as a Nam, as a whatever identity you hold, and you cannot be South African. You will be regarded as a native. But, oh, you can take this colored identity, and with it, we will give you this benefit. And, of course, those benefits were not the same benefits that white people got. So even within the little, you know, sort of layer of superiority where you got a little bit more than Black people. So you got slightly bigger houses. You got a slightly bigger playground. You got slightly better school. But they were not as good as what the Indians got. They got bigger houses than the colored people. They got bigger playgrounds than the colored people. And even they didn't get the best, because the white people got the biggest houses, the best schools, and you know, and the best playgrounds. And that continues even to this day. That's why you'll never see in South Africa, there are no white people who live in townships, mm-hmm. because it's not a desirable area, because there aren't resources in townships, and because it wasn't built as an area for human development, or as an area where people are meant to thrive. And so people outside of Black people do not see townships as places where they can live. And that's why what we see is a one-directional move, where it's Black people moving into colored neighborhoods, moving into Indian neighborhoods, moving into so-called former white neighborhoods, because that's where the schools, the best schools are, that's where the better schools are, that's where the better resources are, and that's where South Africa infrastructurally caters to first. If there's load shedding, it's going to happen in the Black neighborhoods first. If there's you know, 4 hours versus 2 hours, the white neighborhoods will get 2 hours, mm-hmm. and the Black neighborhoods mm-hmm. will get four hours of load shedding. Whether you're talking electricity, or you're talking water, or you're talking any issue. And so the apartheid infrastructure continues. The apartheid experience continues, even though we've removed the laws. And so we shouldn't be surprised when young people then show us where we are and the work that we need to do. And when teachers themselves are showing that they haven't been trained in the ways that they need to be trained to be able to handle our history and engage with our history.
Can we take a call? Asanda, there is Stanley on the line. Stanley, thanks for calling. Good evening and welcome.
How are you, my sister?
I'm good. Thanks for calling.
I'm good. Look, man, this thing of racism, it's something that I want to, like, the kids, they learn it from Tinabantabatala, like, they learn it from us, because I've got a child who's got a special need, right? Like, she's partly deaf, so she's using hearing aid. And she goes to a school, it's a special school, which is a school for mostly white, colored, and also black. It's in Pechua and Islam.
Mm.
So she goes, and when she comes out of, you know, it's safe when she's on the school field, but when they're outside, that they'll be telling her that she's not good enough to be there, she doesn't belong there. Because one day she told me that one of the girls told her that, you know, why we don't want you guys in our school is because your hair are as small as your brains.
Mm.
And then in terms of that, you know, last 2 weeks back, when the school reopened, after school, when she was walking, you know, because these kids, they were bullying her and stuff, they end up taking her hearing aids, you know, they were running with them, and they end up pulling them down and crushing them. And when we go and tell the parents, you know, the parents will act like they don't know nothing and they can't afford hearing. And remember, she depends on her disability grant. We are not working. So for us to get new hearing aids, and she's writing matric, for us to get her new hearing aid, we need to get how much? At the private hospital, it will be 8,500. And for us, now we have applied, we have checked her to a government hospital. They say we can wait for 6 to 9 months, over a year, because they've got backlog. So you see now what they did because of their dirty heart and their parents not teaching them that we are all equal. It means my daughter won't be able to write her grade 12 preliminary and also final exams.
Stanley, that's a painful story. How did the school react to that?
No, they've called them, they've suspended them, but they've only suspended them for a month, to which they'll be able to come back and write the exams. But my daughter won't be, because she wouldn't. I as a father, I don't have medical aid, so I can't afford to get her a new hearing aid. So they've been punished, but I don't think the punishment was enough, because it's only for a month.
Yeah.
But look at my daughter now. She won't be able to write because she doesn't have hearing aid. And we can't afford it. We must wait for the hospital to call us and say we've got hearing aid. It can take us 6 to 9 to 12 months. So that means
thanks, Stanley. Thank you. Asanda, for me, this is just it, right? So whatever actions we embark on, there isn't the sense that there is a true understanding of how deeply this racism hurts us. I don't think there's an appreciation. For me, we don't see even government making it a priority to just, I mean, and I want to give you an example of, for instance, Germany, that did the hard work of, first of all, accepting that the Holocaust happened here. And we need to do a lot more than just accepting. We need to do work in accepting that we've hurt the other, and we need to work. I'm not seeing that intentionality coming from this nation.
Well, this is the problem, right? We don't have the political will. And I mean, I think before I even go to that, I want to just point out a couple of things with what that painful story that the father has told. And you'll see that he's focusing on the practical, that the child now doesn't have hearing aid and therefore cannot write matric. That is but a fraction of the trauma and the pain of this. Because, yes, that's one thing that's practical. There is also the emotional damage and trauma that his daughter is going through, having been stripped literally of, like, because that is a physical violation when somebody grabs something out of your ear that you actually depend on, and then when they say words to you that to them say that you don't belong in a space. And unfortunately, that father's story is not the only story. I promise you, we could have an entire, you could have your radio, Kaya FM could literally for the whole day give people the opportunity to talk about the experiences of racism, and we could literally spend 365 days talking about experiences of racism, and we still wouldn't have scratched the surface, because there isn't political will to deal with this. And unfortunately, the government saw it fit in its GNU, which I think is a great idea, by the way, but they saw it fit to put a minister of basic education, which is going to take us back even further, because the DA was against Bella, because Bella is actually meant in part to deal with some of these issues, because it takes away the power from the SGB that has been repeatedly accused of being racist in how they choose who gets to enter public schools or not. And the SGB is where the power of racism in this country lies. And in implementing Bella, the government was trying to undo this and also ensure, for example, that, you know, we are not stuck in this. Children must learn in English and Afrikaans at the expense of the African languages, which is something that, you know, in 1976, young people died so that nobody in this country ever has to learn in Afrikaans by force. And yet we are putting generations upon generations upon generations of young people through Afrikaans, and many are failing you know, they are failing the year, are failing matric exams and everything in between, because they're just not scaling in Afrikaans, because it's not only their second language, it's also, it's not their second language, their third, it's their fourth, it's sometimes even their fifth language. And there isn't an appreciation, for example, that South Africa has a linguistic diversity such that if you talk to any child in Soweto, they can speak at least three languages before we even get to English and Afrikaans. If you go and you talk to a child in Limpopo, they can speak at least three languages before you get to English and Afrikaans. But there's this prioritization of English and Afrikaans such that if you don't know English and Afrikaans, you could know 20 languages, but you won't be recognized as literate.
You won't be recognized as somebody...
Yeah, who's able to pass.
Yeah.
And so it goes far deeper than just these incidents. And I want to go back a little bit to the incident that happened at Pretoria Girls, where 12 young girls were suspended.
Mm.
If you, I mean, I saw from the news, I've been looking at some of those screenshots, and some of those screenshots speak to microaggressions, which speak to the issue that you were talking about, that these girls were saying that some of these things that the black girls are complaining about don't even make sense.
Sort of thing, yeah.
And they talk about microaggressions as if they are not aggressions and they are not trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, this is exactly the thing, that people hear black people talk about their daily experience. And somehow it's like, because we experience this thing daily and are able to live and survive, right? Then it's not seen as a painful, life-ending thing. Despite the fact that, you know, research globally has shown that black people are dying younger because we have stress from constantly facing racism. We have stress and repeat, because we don't only have trauma, we don't just have racial trauma, we have repeated trauma, which means that we are in a permanent state of post-traumatic stress. We never even get to the post, because you're moving from an incident of racism today to an incident of racism tomorrow to another incident of racism on another day. And you're lucky if you have a day in this country where you don't experience racism. And for me, what breaks my heart is that when people start to talk about it, then the people who are talking about it, the people who are advocating about it, me and many others who do this work, we get given such a hard time, and we end up being attacked instead of people talking about the fact that we have this unfinished history that we need to deal with. And what breaks my heart is that as a country, we have overcome so much, including a lot of the racial conflict. It's less than what it was, but it's still painful, and it's still, you know, quite distracting. And we aren't even able to see, for example, that we have overcome in this country religious diversity. We have religious diversity in this country. Muslim people, Christian people, Jewish people, people of all faiths and religions are able to gather, are able to celebrate their religions in peace in this country. And that's something that, you know, Palestine wishes it could have. That's something that the people of many, many countries, including even countries like France, where you can't wear a burqa if you want to, people wish they could have the level of religious freedom and diversity that we have. We have people being able to marry, people of same sex being able to marry each other, being able to live together. And these are freedoms that many people wish for. So we have achieved so much in terms of diversity, embracing diversity, and living in diversity. But when it comes to this one thing, we refuse to deal with it. We refuse to engage with it. So we have, you know, these headlines that talk about racism and the problems that we have. And then it becomes like GBV. We blast the headlines for a couple of, you know, for a time frame, and then everybody kind of gets tired and moves on to the next thing.
I want to ask though, Asanda, when you go deep, when you go and have these consultations with schools and companies and the like, are we really, really, as society, willing to do the work? Even for us who face the trauma, are we really willing to do the work? In the sense, if a colleague of mine decided to come to work, ngebeshu, as an argument, for argument's sake, right? The entire company will be up in arms about company policy, it's indecent, and. And it may seem like an extreme excuse here, example. But the point I'm making is that how intentional and how sincere are we about deracializing our institutions, our policies, our daily lives, because it's part of that. You spoke about the hierarchical structures that were in apartheid system that said, you know, there's a hierarchy of how far you can go in this level of discrimination. And we maintain that. Mm. We maintain that. We ourselves, even as black people, still think, you know, when you have flowing hair, it's better than not having your natural hair. Oh, no, it's untidy. These are policies that are in school governing body documents. It's what is untidy, what is tidy is very European. It's very white. There's whiteness about it.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I often talk about South Africans of all races having been raised in a cult.
Mm.
And so we were raised in the cult of racism, and we all of us, every single one of us, internalized those messages. Mm. So what that means is that black people have work to do to liberate themselves, to unlearn the racism that, you know, they were raised with. Like, for instance, if somebody speaks broken English, we laugh at them. But if a French person comes and speaks broken English, we think it's sexy. Mm. We think it's all of these things. That is internalized racism, because you can recognize that the person has another language when it's French, but you can't recognize that a person has another language if it's Xhosa or Zulu or any other language. And so we need to do this work. And I think, you know, I've been to many companies who are really committed to doing this work. I've worked with many schools who are committed to doing this work. And when they do this work, so we've got schools where we've got a curriculum in place, the policies are in place, we train teachers regularly, we engage with students regularly, and we have engagement even with parents. And in these schools where this work is done and where this work is done regularly, they have other problems, but racism is not one of them. And even when racism issues or issues around racism do rear up, having a curriculum in place, having all of these things in place means it gets handled better. The children themselves, when they experience these things, handle them better. They report much faster. They engage on these issues and are even able to kind of engage with them amongst themselves, such that by the time they go to the relevant teacher, they already even are putting forward a solution, because it's something they understand and it's something that they own. And I think that, you know, this is the problem that people don't understand. That, you know, I often say that, you know, everybody understands when they need to put in a new version of software. I've never come to a company that insisted that they're not going to load the latest version of software, despite the issues that were happening. I've never come across that. And companies will pay whatever price is set as a price for a software upload. And companies will pay for the training that the staff needs to go to in order for the software to be implemented. But when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion, companies are stuck, and they're not interested in, first of all, understanding what are the upgrades that they need to have in their learning, that their staff need to have. What are the policies that they need to put in place? They then haggle on the money. How much does it cost to actually do this training? So if it's a training around software, they'll take whatever price is given. But if you come as a diversity expert and you're giving them your price, they're like, but it costs so much. And you're like, how much does other training cost? You know, and they're shocked when you even do that comparative analysis. And so there's a sense in which we think, by virtue of being human and living on this planet, that we are equipped to deal with race. And perhaps if we had lived in a world where we didn't have colonialism and we didn't have apartheid, and people were engaging, you know, as human beings engaging on the planet, you know, and having cross-cultural interactions and trade, then it would be fine. But that's not the case. We live in a world that was built around race, and that was built particularly to ensure that one particular race is seen as inferior and is treated unfairly. And so we cannot do the work of wanting to have this kumbaya, let's be post-racial, without actually doing the difficult work. And you know, I've heard people say, you know, I feel like DEI is part of the problem because it creates an antagonistic relationship, and now you've got a perpetrator and a victim, and now it's difficult to get out of those boxes. And I say, you can do all the work that you want to do. You can bring people together. You can get people to get along. But if you are not going to deal with the elephant in the room, that the genesis of racism is colonialism, that the genesis of racism is apartheid, that the genesis of racism is an ideology that sees white people as superior and sees black people as superior, then you haven't done any DEI work. Then you're simply wasting that company's money and you're simply wasting everybody's time, because you are going to continue to come back to this problem until you start dealing with it head on and you start engaging with it head on. And so, as I said, there are companies that are doing this work, that are paying the money that they need to pay, that are bringing on all kinds of different people, from diversity experts to change management experts to psychologists to trauma counselors to coaches. There are many people in this literal industry who do this work, and have been doing this work, by the way, before Black Lives Matter, have been doing this work before Sigma's Fall, and have been doing this work since even before 1994, when we actually were able to even say the word racism. But there's a sense in which people are in denial about the need for this work. And so once you know you've got a company that's already committed, that's the easy part. Because once you get in and you do your work, then people will engage and people will, people do. I mean, in my experience, 99.9% of the time, people are actually surprised at how amazing a session is and how connected they feel to their colleagues. Because I particularly focus my work on storytelling and getting people to tell stories of who they are and how they came to be. And you'll be surprised at how much colleagues don't know each other. And so people live together, I mean, work in the office together for 10 years, and they don't know that their colleague lives, they know that they live in Soweto, but they don't know which particular place in Soweto. Or they know that their colleague lives in Naledi, but they don't know that they live in a shack in Naledi, and these are the conditions that they live in. They've never bothered to ask, they've never bothered to engage. And so all of these things, where a person lives, who they live with, how much
time it takes them to get to work,
how much time it takes them to, it has so many implications. And I've been in companies where, you know, people were shocked that their own colleagues wake up at 3 a.m. when they only wake up
30 minutes away.
And they live 30 minutes away.
Can we take a quick break, Asanda? And we'll take more of those questions and comments. 086-000-0959. You can send the voice notes on 063-688-0959. Asanda Ngwasheng is my guest. She's a diversity training expert. Lots to talk about. I think there's a lot for us to engage with. There's a lot that we need to accept. This is a painful conversation, and I know it's not usually the kind of conversation we like to always engage in, but let's try, you know, and let's be honest about what the conditions really are in the real South Africa. As a Black South African, how are you experiencing this country? It's not by chance that we are seeing what we are seeing in the schools. We certainly are living in a country that has not dealt with its issues. So let's talk about it. 086-000-0959. Asanda Ngwasheng is my guest. We are discussing diversity in South Africa. This is on the back of all the kinds of incidents that we've been seeing in Cape Town. We've seen this at Pretoria Girls High, and we need to talk about what's going on. Asanda, let me just ask you this. Are we in denial about the fact that not all South Africans want the same thing? Not all South Africans want us to be equal. It must benefit others. This is why we're not confronting it, and pretending like it doesn't exist actually is a form of, you know, just saying, well, it actually works for me, so why should I?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, I want to reiterate that I believe, and I still believe this, having done this work, I believe that the majority of South Africans do want South Africa to work. They do want to live in a country where everybody, you know, is able to have a meal at night, where everybody has a job, and where everybody is able to live in harmony. Because a lot of South Africans understand that, you know, if you continue to live in this inequality, it's going to have an impact on those who have, won't be able to enjoy what they have, because there's going to be crime, there's going to be all these issues that are socioeconomic that, you know, make, you know, almost every South African problem kind of flows out of that. So as long as you have inequality, and that inequality is racial, everything flows out of that. So the majority of South Africans know that.
Can I
are on board with that.
Can I push back on that, Asanda, in this sense? If it were true that the majority of South Africans understand that inequality is problematic and inequality is not going to serve us, we wouldn't be sitting here 30 years on, and we are one of the most unequal countries in the world. And you still have, and this is my concern, you still have
you know, quite a sizable number of South Africans who vote for political parties that don't see that, that have policies that actually advance inequality, that don't want to talk about minimum wage, that don't want to talk about the Bella Bill, for instance, that want to advance only one particular race. It is problematic because those parties thrive. They have a sizable chunk of South Africans who vote for them.
Yes, well, this is. I was going to finish my sentence.
Oh, sorry.
The majority of South Africans understand inequality and the impact, the negative impact that it has on all of us, whether you are on the haves or not have side. But what we cannot agree on is how. How do we get to a place of equity? Who needs to give up what? And how do we balance the scale? So it's up until that point where people realize that they have to give up something in order for this equality to be realized. It's at the point where people realize that in order for them to have this lavish life, where there are people who work for them and are basically serving them hand and foot, that they are able, like, it's basically that their lives are built on this inequality. And once you destroy this inequality, it's not going to be as easy to get a domestic worker, a nanny, a butler, a doorman, and all of those, you know, creature comforts that they think they deserve. And that is where then the problem is. I also want to even engage what you're saying about why do we still have people who are voting for these political parties. If you look at the numbers, it is only about 20. So you've got the DA, for example, which has been very clear that they're not interested in understanding how race continues to have an impact today. They think it's socioeconomic. They think we shouldn't engage it. But the DA only got just over 20% of the vote. You've got the Freedom Front Plus, which espouses similar and even slightly more extreme versions of that, but they only got about 2% of the vote. And so you have less than, you have, you know, at a maximum, only up to about, let's say, 25% of the popular vote has gone to political parties that have these views. And so that tells you that the majority of South Africans do not want this. And if you look at, for example, we're talking about the DA particularly, they actually haven't grown, if you think about it. If you think about the previous election, they haven't grown in terms of the numbers. And so what that means is that the number of South Africans who still believe in their vision hasn't grown. That's why we have a GNU now. That's why, you know, they were even willing to go to bed with the ANC, effectively. But, I mean, before we go to the other side of my brain, which is all political. I think it's important to state, it's very important for us to understand that the majority of South Africans want inequality to end. Because I think once we can get stuck very quickly in this belief that South Africans don't want. Most South Africans want inequality to end. Where we can't agree and where we diverge is how that inequality must end. And the fact that some people need to give up the privilege that they currently have in order for that inequality to be actualized. And again, I want to emphasize that we also need to, when it comes to the issue of race, we also need to think about race not as this one big monolith problem with people who are equally racist, if I can call it that. So you have the extreme outliers who are people who are like, bring back apartheid, we do not want these blacks anywhere near any position of power and whatever. And those people are actually in a minority in South Africa. And then you have the particular group of white people who might be interested in engaging in conversation about inequality, but in the main, they still want to continue to have their privilege. And then you have some people who are actually doing a lot of work and really putting in the work of trying to unlearn racism and trying to not act in ways that are discriminatory or act in ways that are going to hurt and harm South Africans. Because I think, you know, that's why I highlighted, for instance, that we are winning in diversity when it comes to religion, and we are winning in diversity when it comes to language and linguistic diversity and various other aspects of diversity. Where we have an issue is the racial one, because there are economic benefits attached racism, right? Our entire system is still built on the white man continuing to be the biggest benefactor. And so if you look at where the best schools in South Africa are, there are informal white areas. But unfortunately, our government also needs to take responsibility for this, to say that our government has not built multiracial places and spaces. We shouldn't still be, it shouldn't still be that, you know, we still talk about black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods, because by now the government should have built enough interracial neighborhoods that do not belong to any specific race, and schools that do not belong to any specific race, because South Africans of all races, of all hues and of all classes would be able to access them. So if you go to other countries, you'll see that, for instance, they have laws that say you cannot build a you know, a multi-million rand apartment without having affordable apartments, you know, even if it's like one floor or two floors. And so across Europe, for example, you'll find that there are apartments where the richest of the rich live in the penthouses and in the top floors, and then the bottom floors are occupied by people who are middle class, and then the very, very bottom floors are occupied by people who are working class, because that is how you kind of enforce society to engage and live and see each other, such that we don't have what we have in South Africa, where we have rich, rich suburbs where only rich, rich people live, and they never have to encounter, you know, poor or working class people unless they're driving from the airport. I mean, sometimes I even see, like, if there was a way to create a tunnel from the airport to Kemp's Bay, people would literally do that, for example, in Cape Town, so they never have to encounter the blackness or the poverty of this country.
We've got a call, Asanda, coming in for you. Mawande is calling from Turfontein. Thanks for calling, and thanks for your patience, Mawande. Oh, we can't hear you, Mawande. Just speak closer to your mic.
Yes, yes, can you hear me?
Yes, lovely, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Yes, go ahead, sir, we are listening.
Hello?
Yes, I'm saying Asanda can hear you, go ahead.
Can I talk now?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, thank you.
Mm.
I just want to make two or three statements. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The first one is by the apartheid architect, Hendrik Verwoerd. He said that he will design apartheid in such a way that no government will undo it. The second one is the ANC president who said in the 60s that South Africa will have a kind of democracy that the world will listen and learn from. And then I want to debate the latter. No? Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. We're listening, hey?
Oh, okay. I want to debate the latter that South Africa, we've got 30 years of democracy.
Mm.
And in those 30 years, we've heard about four or five major policies, government policies, to change the country's direction to the prosperity for to bring prosperity for everybody. However, the challenge remains what you were debating, you know, the education and all that, and for South Africa to move forward, I think we need it's a collective thing. Yeah? Better life for all is attainable if we all put our action behind the effort. You know, and better life is possible for all South Africans. It's just that it's the willingness part of it.
Mm.
And that goes to both leadership and people on the ground. What I also want to say is that for South Africa to go forward, it's not just the past, you know.
Mm.
It's everybody needs to be involved. And for that to happen, we need leadership.
Mm.
that shows the direction.
Mm. Asanda, your response to that?
Hello?
No. We heard you loud and clear. I just wanted a response from Asanda.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I agree in part and I disagree in part. So I think, you know, we can't look at our democracy and say because we are failing in this one aspect, our democracy is a failed project. I don't believe in that. I think our democracy has many aspects of it which have been good, and we are in learning, and there's a lot that we still need to work on. And I think that's why people voted in the interesting way that they voted, and we sit now with the GNU and we sit with the potential national dialogue and so much more, you know, many interesting things that are about to happen. I think, you know, I can honestly say, as somebody who's done this work, not just in South Africa, but globally, one interesting thing I noticed, for example, is that in South Africa, we talk about racism. So we don't always like talk about it in the office as openly and honestly or whatever, but we do talk about it. We talk about it more, for instance, than the UK does, right? So people in the UK don't have these open debates and conversations about racism in the ways that we have them here in South Africa, mm-hmm. whether you're talking about ordinary one-on-one conversations mm-hmm. or conversations in the office or conversations even at a national level, for example. Mm-hmm. So there are very interesting ways in which we engage this issue. So we have installed it. We're working on solving it, but there are some ways in which we are further ahead than most places because we talk about it and we engage the issue. So we don't have, government hasn't done the work that it needs to do of ensuring that there's a department whose sole job is to look at this thing. Mm-hmm. They haven't implemented a lot of the things they need to do. But as ordinary South Africans, we do spend a lot of time talking about this issue. And talking about it is important because mm-hmm. it's an acknowledgement that it exists and it's a thing that we need mm-hmm. to think about. Mm-hmm. And then the second part that I wanted to talk about is, I think, you know, I think he's right that it does, for this democracy to work, for the change to happen, for inequality to end, we all need to do our part. And we all need to work together. All of us, black, white, colored, Indian, all of us need to work together. Because one of the things that I keep emphasizing that concerns me is that we are now dealing with two layers of a problem, right? We're dealing with a problem where black people in the majority are unemployed and poor and hungry, effectively, mm-hmm. right? There's mm-hmm. widespread poverty mm-hmm. and hunger. And white people continue to own the economy, continue to own the land, and continue to have the means of production. But at the same time, you also have this widening gap, inequality, between black people themselves, right? So while in apartheid, it was almost a given that we were all likely to be poor, with maybe one or two middle class to rich people. Mm. What's happening is that even within one family, the income gap is widening. So you have one family member who's very rich, and then you have a family member who's middle class, and then you have a family member who's poor to a point where they are actually living in hunger. Mm. And what this does is that it means that even our ability to come together as black people to say these are the problems that we have and that we want to be solved is diminishing. Because one of the things we had which helped us to end apartheid was we had solidarity as black people. And then you had UDF which came in and said we actually need solidarity between black people, colored and Indian people. And so that solidarity is waning because black people, you know, black middle class and wealthy people don't even live in the township anymore. And so black people who are middle class and upper middle class need diversity training themselves at this point mm-hmm. around issues of class, mm-hmm. around issues of how we engage with our poorer cousin, how we engage with our working class colleagues and siblings, around the fact that more often than not, when you're sitting, you know, when there's a global or even a national panel, the people who are representing black people there are not working class black people. It is middle class black people. It is wealthy black people. It is black people who speak with an accent like mine, who went to former white schools, and therefore know how to speak the language of English to the people that needs to be spoken to. And so we are having a situation where even the black working class voices in this country mm. are being buried further and further and deeper mm. into silencing, right? So we are basically, our solidarity and our ability to come together is dissipating, which means that even when we come to the table, if somebody says, okay, right, come to the table, black people, what do you want? The things we are going to mention as the things that we want are going to be different, right? Mm-hmm. Because the working class people are going to be wanting jobs, are going to be wanting ways to feed their family. The middle class people are going to be complaining about what? Potholes and the fact that, you know, private education is expensive and the fact that medical aid is expensive. Mm-hmm. The wealthy people are going to be complaining about their inability to move their money overseas. Mm-hmm. And so on and so on. And so you see that now what then happens is that the black people who are middle class and wealthy are moving closer and closer in interest to the white people who have the money already. So, and moving further away from the bulk of black people, which is the poor and the working class. And so, for instance, one of the things I've been saying, I'm excited about with this GNU and everything that has happened, for instance, is the fact that labor unions are going to have to labor. You know, shop stewards are going to have to shop stewards. And workers' interests are going to take priority and be led by the actual unions and not via the proxy of the conversations happening in the alliance. Because that's the problem that we have, that even where we had potential solidarity before, that solidarity doesn't exist anymore. And I mean, I've spoken about how the interests of the working class people are not taken care of. What I also haven't spoken about or need to speak about, for instance, is that at the same time you have this deepening hatred between middle class and poor and working class people. Mm-hmm. So poor and working class people look at black people who are middle class and wealthy as if they sold out. They sold out to the system, and they don't care about them.
We need a longer conversation. We've totally run out of time. Asana Oshanga, thank you so much. We do need a longer conversation. She's a diversity expert. I'm going to come back with a conversation with ESCOM. They've got something that we all need to be paying attention to. When I come back, we'll talk to them in a short while.
I think that other races have gotten away with treating us ill and treating us as an inferior race, so much that even when they say disgusting things to us or about us, they don't realize that they've been disgusting. They think it's normal behavior. Like how a marketing manager told me that wearing a wig is a much better option for a jewelry brand where I'm concerned. Just basically calling my hair ugly in front of other people. And when I got upset, other black people were wondering why it was offensive for her to say that, because she has the privilege of wearing her natural hair every single day without anybody saying anything. She can just go on and wear purple hair, pink hair, red hair, and nobody's going to say anything. They will think, oh, freedom of choice. But as soon as a black girl does it, then it's like, oh, we have options. We don't like you like this. We actually like you like that. It's the thing that they've always been able to get away with it that makes them think this behavior is appropriate.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.